I'm Anita Lustria, and this is Faith Conversations. Today on the podcast, I have with me Rick McKinley. I'm excited about this podcast for a couple of reasons. One, because I think the book that Rick has written, his latest one, is worth talking about, and that's why I've got him here. Faith for This Moment. I love the subtitle. This is what really leaped out at me: Navigating a Polarized World as the People of God. And if you don't think we're in a polarized world, your head's in the sand. You know, we just came through midterm elections, and that's just one thing that probably leaps out. Just a few weeks ago, that was going on, and certainly felt like a polarized world to me, and still feels that way. So I'm excited to welcome Rick McKinley to the podcast. Let me just tell you a little bit about him, because this is going to help us as time moves along. He is the founder and lead pastor of Imago Dei Community and is the author of 5 books. He's a conference speaker, and some of you have probably heard him at Q, Catalyst, the Justice Conference, to name a few. He is living in Portland, Oregon, and that probably says it all, right? We'll talk to him more about that in just a few minutes. But he is widely respected as a leader there who navigates the issues surrounding faith, culture, and the church. And he and his wife and 4 children live in Portland, Oregon. And Rick, welcome to Faith Conversations.
Thank you for having me. It's so good to be with you.
Well, good to have you. And I said the first reason why I am glad that you're with me on the podcast today, and that has to do with the content of what you're most recently writing about. But secondly, because this has been a hard podcast to get to happen. I canceled the first time, but late last minute, it was, you know, I don't like doing that, blah, blah, blah. And then this time, I hit record, and my SD card was full, and I couldn't figure out how to dump it, and finally got help for that. So we've had problems getting this podcast going.
Yeah.
So I'm really believing it's going to be good because of all the stuff that's gotten in the way.
That's right.
Well, I want to start by asking you a little bit about living in Portland, Oregon. Partly, you write about this at the beginning of the book, but this is something that's kind of on my mind. It feels or seems to me, even though I've never been to Portland, Oregon, like Portland is sort of a microcosm of a picture, this picture of the country, maybe. I mean, it's certainly, and this is my assumption, so you tell me yes or no if I'm right or wrong, that it's an interesting and maybe even tough place to be a follower of Jesus.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the most unchurched cities. I mean, all cities tend to hit that list. But, you know, Seattle and Portland, San Francisco, they're always on the top of that list. And what that means, I think, is we've been at this now for about 18 years, is that people don't have a religious history. So it's more so that than, say, like in the South, you might be working with a non-churched group of people, but they probably connect to something in their past, some time that they went to church, where it's very often the case that you find people coming to faith that go, I have, like, my parents think this is crazy, my grandparents think this is crazy. So without that religious history, everything's sort of open game. All kinds of spirituality is just interesting, and people are pursuing that. So it's spiritual but not religious, but in that spiritual, it's very eclectic.
So that's part of it. So a piece of my assumption is correct. You know, I mean, you hear snippets again. I need to visit. And because you hear these wonderful things about Portland, the arts community, and a lot of wonderful things that are happening there, certainly. And I'm kind of chuckling a little bit about your, at the illustration of in the South here. It is religion.
Am I right about that?
Well, religion and Christianity in particular is so cultural. I mean, everyone knows biblical allusions or literary allusions. I mean, it's you rarely run into someone, unless where I am, which is Sarasota, Florida, which is an artistic area and a little more hippy-dippy, you know. And I know there are pockets certainly in Florida and in the South, but I'm speaking out of my experience here in Florida. But the majority, we share a common language whether someone goes to church or not.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think that's really interesting to live in a place where, in some ways, there's no shared religious history.
Yeah. And what's kind of beautiful about that is that we have such a great unity among churches. There's no competition, you know. If you have the best parking lot, the best worship, the best, you know, whatever, you're still not going to have people come to your church. So we have this going joke between three or four of us that there's 300 people that are traveling from our churches to each other, you know, complaining about the last one. But that's about as big as the pocket is. It's not.
Wow.
So we know those church shopper people, but we're for each other because we don't, you know, you're trying to work in a not very civil, somewhat hostile, incredibly beautiful, open-minded, fun city, you know.
And again, this might be an assumption, but my experience here, and I'll relate it to the assumption piece of Portland that I have, but here people attend church because it's what you do. It is a cultural norm here, not because you want to deepen your relationship with Christ. It's just something we do, and then we go have family dinner together,
yeah.
You know, where I have this assumption that in Portland, you know, people are going because they need and want that support somewhere along the way of their week. They want to deepen their relationship with Christ. So that's my assumption. Tell me if that's correct or not.
Yeah, I would say there's a congregation who comes for that purpose. There's a community that comes for all kinds of reasons,
yeah.
Whether it's belonging, they love the art stuff we do, they love justice stuff, and then there's sort of the crowd, which is kind of our community as well, because they're from Portland, and they come before they go to the Buddhist temple. Mm. You know, they come for all kinds of reasons. So what it's great for is the Christian language that I think particularly evangelicals have adopted, that doesn't work, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Someone accepts Jesus into their heart. I'll never forget when I first started the church, this lady ran a Pilates studio, very open-minded, kind of new age spirituality, and she said, "Yes, I know he's in my heart. I can feel him right here." And she points to her navel and her kind of chest bone.
Yes.
And says, "Jesus is right here inside of me." And I just was a little lost for words. I'm like, okay, that wasn't exactly what we were talking about. So you have
kind of reframe that.
And it's so, but that's so fun, you know. I didn't grow up in the church, so like literally we never went to church.
Okay.
So it kind of is my barbarian crowd that doesn't know how to do it. And
what's your story? Yeah. What's your story? I mean, how'd you wind up doing what you do if you did, you know, you had none of those roots? Interesting.
Yeah, so I grew up in the Bay Area, and then we moved to Sacramento and hit high school and just kind of went crazy, partying and, you know, sports and the popularity, that kind of stuff. And then when I graduated, I went to Chico State because it was the number one party school in Playboy that year.
Wow.
That's a degree I want to pursue. And kind of, as weird as it sounds, that's where I had a spiritual hunger develop. Chico is very spiritual, and yet you still have 900 people, you know, at a 50 keg party, and there's another one down the street. And so you had all that. But then I would watch these people meditating on the grass, and I'd be like, man, that looks good. Then I go back, and I'm a offensive lineman kind of body type, so trying to like sit crisscross applesauce was so painful that I couldn't even pull it off. But I dropped out of Chico, just kind of hit a wall, came home, continued that lifestyle, and then woke up one day and decided I have to go to church. And I have no idea why.
Wow.
And I went to the church closest to my house, and it was Palm Sunday.
Huh.
And I didn't know what that meant. I literally thought they were going to read my palm.
Oh, wow.
I know.
Okay.
I mean, that sounds ridiculous, but I had no idea how all of it fit together.
It's a great
story. What was beautiful is, you know, I'm not, like, I could have went pretty much to any church, and I wasn't going to miss the gospel story that week. They're just telling the story, and at the end of that, I was like, I'm in, you know, I'm in. My dad said, if you go to church, those people come to your house. And I'm like, what are you talking about? We've never been to church. How would you know? And sure enough, Wednesday night, two guys in suits knock on the door. And all of a sudden, I thought my dad was a genius. I'm like, how did you know these people were going to show up at my house? And about 9 months after that, I went to Bible college up here in Multnomah, just because I felt so far behind in this, you know, felt this call to do something, you know, for Christ. And it was too soon for the Bible college and too soon for me, but I made it. told dirty jokes to my professors that I thought were clean, but they weren't.
Wow.
So, yeah, it was kind of a big transition for me. And then I was 10 years, you know, in the church trying to figure out, like, how you relate to this Christian culture. The whole time knowing that the people I love and I have affinity with, like, they aren't going to walk in here and ever show up to this kind of place. That's what pushed us, I think, to come to Portland and go downtown Portland and try to be a church for the city.
Wow. Okay, this raises a lot of other questions for me, not the least of which is I grew up in an evangelical culture that was very much about, you know, bring someone to Christ, but don't really have a real relationship with them. It's just a notch on your belt. You're in a climate and culture both where, I mean, you have to be in this for the long haul. You have to develop real and true relationships if you have any hope of, you know, having the relational capital to have a conversation about some of the deeper things of life, of your life and of in other people's lives. And I have since learned, you know, that I've thrown that model out the window and understand, and part of it's my makeup. I mean, I love people and just getting to know them and their story and just hanging with them for, you know, however long. Is that part of a little piece of what it looks like where you are?
Oh, yeah, for sure. And I think part of the shift that we've had to make is the mindset of getting people to come to church versus going, you know, going to them.
Yeah.
They come to church, you know, maybe, but the going is the thing that has to continue and be consistent. And so, you know, on a large scale, we've been able to do that in terms of serving Portland and building relationships that way. And about after 8 years of that, you know, knowing you're going to show up every week, we were able to start building a relationship with the mayor and different city officials. The church of Portland, the larger church, started realizing, wow, you know, this is safe. We can do this. And so now we have like an incredible relationship with the governor in terms of working with foster care, every mayor that's come through. And And those become, like, there's so many relationships in that context, whether it's a superintendent, a principal, a teacher, a family. So, yeah, there's the neighborhoodness of just living our life, and then there's sort of the larger going that puts us in those spaces.
Wow. Thanks for that. It's a little off track. Well, not really of your book, but I wanted to hear that part of your story. So let's, blast forward a little bit and enter into the picture Faith for This Moment, all about navigating a polarized world as the people of God. I think in every author's life, there's this inciting incident or incidents that kind of propel us toward writing about a specific topic or give us the angle toward a particular topic we've been, noodling around on for a while. What was that for you that propelled you into the writing of this?
Yeah, well, I think it's a, like you said, it's a little early that these things hit us here in Portland. So the idea of a follower of Jesus being marginalized, having a marginal space in the cultural ethos, that's very familiar to us. And so we've been working out for years, how do we become the type of Christ followers that can be faithful, even though we're sort of marginalized by the wider culture? And that's where the metaphor of exile came up. So when I finally wrote the book, we'd been in the dialogue of that for a long time, like looking at how can we be faithful in a way that doesn't assimilate to culture, but also doesn't sort of, try to burn it down and recreate, take America back or make it great again. So after the election, this book was pretty much done, and yet I felt
presidential
like
election. I'll add
the president. Yeah, way back then. Yeah, we just finished an election, but that I think everyone felt the chasm that got created for us. We lost 300 people at the church, on the right and the left.
Mm.
And so seeing how politics so anchors our identity as people, even people of faith. So we had, Republicans leave, we had Democrats leave, because I didn't say, I didn't endorse Hillary, but I also didn't, we were very honest about Trump and had some of our African American brothers and sisters share what it was like for them after the election. And Portland was on fire.
Sure.
It was 3 months of riots and protests, and it continues, at least once a month there's the Antifa, and that's sort of the sad part, is people have come in from out of the area to fight with each other, where typical Portland is a protesting activist, culture. Not nearly as violent as we've been seeing. That's coming from without. So I think what was helpful was now the rest of the body of Christ is feeling a similar, chasm. There isn't a clear Christian candidate, even though it's been funny to watch people try to turn Trump into one.
And
not a lot to work with, by the way. So more and more Christians that I know that would be moderate or whatever you would want to call them are asking the question, like, what? How in the world am I supposed to be a Christian in this space?
Yeah.
Where they're not going to think I'm the 80% white Trump voter. And yet I want to be faithful to what I believe, that Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. How do I navigate that?
You write in the book, you pose the question, which I appreciate. I'm a words person and visual learner. I like going back and being able to read the words. How do people who follow Jesus respond in moments like this? And moments like this, you specifically, as you were talking in this particular part of the book, you went back to the horrific shooting at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando, in my neck of the woods, a couple hours away. And, you know, you were listening to this interview on NPR. I actually remember this as well, where the interviewer was asking a pastor, how do evangelicals respond to this crisis when it's very clear politically that evangelicals are anti-gay and pro-gun? And you said, that question rocked me. The pastor was stumped, and you said, I wondered how I would answer the reporter if she were to ask me the same question. What it brought out was that it's not that all evangelicals are anti-gay and pro-gun, but it's that overarching perception, the way that anyone that comes under the umbrella of evangelical has been painted.
Absolutely.
And so what do we do? Where do we go from here?
Yeah, and I think it's not as though I have all the answers. But what I've tried to point out is if we're going to be faithful on this journey, we have to own kind of our own hypocrisy or our own lack of coherence with Jesus. So to assume Jesus is excited that we all get our own gun and, you know, he's so excited that I don't have to have a background check or whatever, that's ridiculous. And anti becomes, it's pro or anti everything. And I found, you know, when you read the Gospels, he's just walking this tightrope between the church and between the culture, and he's really calling both of them on their crap, but doing it with a lot of grace towards the culture. And religious hypocrisy, he gets pretty pissed about.
You know, that's really interesting. Yeah, I was just thinking, okay, the Pharisees, you know, the religious establishment, the religious culture, there you go, but gives a lot more grace toward the culture. So what does that mean, and what does that look like for us who are in the middle of this? Well, let me just say this. I do really like that you have kind of first half, second half of the book, where you're really walking us through where we are now. And that is actually a wake up for some of us. For some people, I think they're just now realizing where we are now. Whereas, as you said earlier, you've been living in Portland a long time. Followers of Christ in Portland, they've known where they are for a long time. Some of this is kind of bleeding into the rest of the country, and people are kind of waking up and going, it's not like it once was. And you talk about being an exile, and that's for those of us who maybe have grown up in the church and have grown up reading the Bible, you know, cover to cover, or reading it every year or something, you know, we kind of know that word, but talk about what that is for those that might be unfamiliar.
Well, honestly, just asking the question, what does it mean to be the people of God now, thrust me back into Scripture. And I was fascinated by exile when Israel was taken into exile in Babylon. They lost their priesthood, they lost the temple, they lost their king, their land, their Hebrew calendar, and they wake up one day in Babylon, which wasn't Pharaoh's Egypt. They weren't in slavery. They were given a middle-class lifestyle. They could start business, right? And Babylon was amazing. Right? Technologically, it was amazing. It was powerful militarily, economically, all these things. So they had to go, what does it mean for us now? And what should have happened is they should have been assimilated by Babylon and gotten wiped out that way. Mm. They should have just sort of dispersed over those 70 years and become, you know, a melting pot of Babylonian. But what happened was their imagination sort of helped them figure out what faithfulness looked like. And that's where you see Sabbath becoming a big distinctive, and they obey it. You see the synagogue arise in terms of smaller groups of people gathering around the word. It becomes much more word-centered. So the scribe shows up on the scene to help interpret the Hebrew language because they weren't speaking it. And there was a remnant that made it through. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when we look at America, we're nowhere near close to what they experienced. Mm-hmm. And but the New Testament also uses the metaphor. They uses exile metaphorically. I just think it's a good way to think about our system because it's simply saying the validating structures and forces that used to be there are no longer there. Mm-hmm. And what I hear is people wanting to go back and somehow bring those institutions and systems back, kind of rebuild Christendom. And I don't think that's the way to go. You know, even I love Jeremiah's letter to the exiles. He's sort of like, you're not going home. So get married, build houses, plant gardens, you're in for the long haul. And I feel like that's true. So how do we navigate this moment and imagine a new way forward?
I like that thought a lot. How do we navigate this moment? But I love the piece, but imagine a new way forward, because that really is what needs to happen. And because it's sort of that definition of insanity to keep doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. And what I mean by doing the same thing over and over again is, you know, posting articles and hoping someone will agree instead of disagree or whatever. You know, it's kind of that piece. You're really just talking to your own group or infuriating another group. Both who may, but here's the piece that I still think is hard. Both who say they love Jesus. This is the piece. This is the piece that I think is so difficult. But you step forward and go, one of the things that's got to happen, and maybe this is a piece of the unifying message that you're talking about. We've got to discover the rhythms of grace, specifically through spiritual practices. Mm-hmm. And I'm guessing that, well, you just mentioned, you know, Sabbath, and this is sort of in mirroring what happened back in Babylon.
Yeah.
Why are these practices so important for us to discover or rediscover today?
Well, when we look at how Christ was navigating his culture and really what Israel was called to do, they weren't called to baptize Babylonian culture and just say, hey, it's all great. Nor were they called to burn it down and fight it and rebuild Israel. But he says very clearly, seek the peace and prosperity of the city in which you live. If it prospers, you will prosper. And really that call to faithfulness in your time and place. For Jesus, we see him walk this tightrope where he's going, look, my kingdom's not of this world, so I'm not, you know, worried about what Rome's doing right now. I'm not going to try to turn it over. And at the same time, I'm going to bless and resist. Like, I'm not going to bow down to the cultural idols, Paul, Peter. And so that is our call in my mind. It's not to say, hey, everything's great, everything can be accepted, Jesus is cool with everything, or no, we have to burn it down and build, you know, Christendom. But it's this, how do we ourselves get transformed by the gospel, by the grace of Christ, so that we can bless and resist the people and resist the idols of our moment.
Isn't that always, never ceases to amaze me, it always comes back to personal transformation. It is about us as individuals growing, becoming more conformed to the image of Christ where we live. You know, it's always about that, about personal mm-hmm. transformation. But you raise, not but, I'll say and, you raise wonderful spiritual practices that you really encourage people to grab hold of in this day that we live that can help us definitely in that personal transformation piece, that can help us reignite our imaginations? Talk about some of these practices and why these particular ones are so important. Or are you just giving an on-ramp to a variety of practices and we can move forward from there and discover others? Or is there something specific or something especially powerful about these that you put forth in the book?
Yeah, I mean, there's tons of spiritual practices. And for your own growth and transformation, I would say go after all of them. These five practices, I think, are what shape a distinct people in our moment. So in other words, they do three things. I call them tri-formational. Mm. They change us. They simultaneously bless the city, the community, the neighbor, and they help resist assimilating to the broader culture. So the first one, the centering practice, is to hear and obey the word and the spirit of God. And that's fighting against an educational model that has kind of taught us to come and grow deep. And when you finally reach some level of mastery, then you go do it. And we see that in college, and we see that in the church. When Jesus says, love your neighbor, he doesn't say, and by the way, here's a 10-week course on how to love your neighbor. We do the same thing that the Pharisees and the people around, well, who's my neighbor and how do I do that and what about this? When he says love your enemy, he doesn't say, but let me define that. So if we're going to hear that, the disciples just, it was come follow, hear and obey. And so now I'm left with, am I going to love my neighbor or am I not? Am I going to sin against God and not love my neighbor? Am I going to love my enemy or not? And it's that, so it's that practice that calls me back to the cross to go, God, I don't have love in my heart for my enemy. You have to give it to me.
Look at you causing trouble. Look at you.
But I didn't come up with it.
Yeah.
It was the Jewish rabbi guy that did that.
Neighbor and enemy. Doesn't that always seem to be the crux of it? That neighbor and enemy seem to be linked to our personal transformation. I see that over and over. It's really interesting. Oh, boy. Okay. All right. Let's move along. No, I mean, I love that. And agree. And I think it's also hard because you've got to start turning the gem to see what all... Who is neighbor? Who is enemy? I mean, you know, these are not quick, easy answers, but man, we can make it quick and easy. We try to.
Yeah.
I think. Yeah.
Or I think we go apathetic and say, well, I don't really know, or, you know, we can't really define it. And so we'll just put it off as opposed to, no, this is what I'm called to now.
Good.
And if he said my neighbor was the, you know, Samaritan, then that opens the door to I got a lot of neighbors that I got to love. And it's not to overwhelm us. It's to say, take that step out your front door and look around, you know.
Yeah.
And the other ones, I think, but again, I just want to emphasize, that pushes up against the idols of our cultural affinity, autonomy. The individual, my concerns are my concerns, your concerns are your concerns. And it also is a huge blessing because if you have people out there that are acting like Jesus acted, right, who are obeying not just the sins of commission, like here are the things you're not supposed to do, but they're obeying the commands that are positive, love, forgive, right, embrace. Mm. These, like, the world would love 1,000 of those people walking around your city.
It's interesting how we gravitate toward the negative as opposed to the positive commands. That's really interesting. I hadn't really thought of it in those terms. Yeah.
Yeah. And Jesus is the only time you see him get harsh is when the religious people are disobeying the positive commands.
Mm.
Right? He's not applauding them for going, look, you know, you're not committing adultery and you're tithing and you're doing these things. He's saying, like, actually, you're just turning these people into to religious minions, you know? So, yeah, there's a ton in each one of these, and I think that's why we stopped at five.
Yeah, because... I get that. I kind of get that now. That's, thank you. Hey, thanks for that. You talk about hospitality. I think there's maybe a resurgence of that spiritual practice, but maybe it's my imagination. I don't know. But talk about why you feel that that's an important one.
Well, again, this is that transformation for me. When we hear hospitality, we normally think about the people we have around our table. And more often than not, in the rat race that we live in, that doesn't happen very often. If it does happen, they are people who are just like me, right? I'm just my friends. And that's okay. That is a form of hospitality. But Jesus pushes it to stranger, you know, and the person that's other. And so which it means there should be an open setting at the table, an open chair, that we're asking, who could we meet? Who could we invite? Who could we call into this space? And the movement is from stranger to guest, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what hospitality does, it transforms the other to guest, to friend, to family.
Mm.
And theologically, the reason that's important is because that's what Jesus did to us. He moved us from stranger to guest, and even allowed us to be the host, where he comes and makes his home inside of us. And so when we understand that guest host relationship between us and Christ, and how he's embraced us rather than excluding us, then we can provide a welcome that a world that's very hostile and isolated can really benefit from.
I have nothing to add.
But that's where, when you think of evangelism today, to me, that's where it needs, you know, that's where it can occur in open dialogue that's not super awkward, because we believe that Christ is at this table with us.
Yes.
You know?
I always tell people, I think we forget, you know, we are carriers of Christ no matter where we go. You know, we're these Christ carriers. And so, yeah, sometimes that's around the table, wherever. And we can't forget that. How empowering that is, but not in a power broker kind of way. You know, totally
exactly,
different.
Yeah.
Hey, talk about generosity. I love that was one of the practices you included. I'm a big fan of that, and I'm really grateful to my parents who really instilled that in me. And I'm not talking about, you know, often we hear that word and we think finances or something, you know, but that's that's like a piece. But talk about the broader practice of generosity and why you felt it was important.
Yeah, generosity, I think, is important, massively important, because in a consumer culture where you find your security, your comfort, your pleasure, your identity in what you make, what you own, what you have, and Jesus comes along and says, actually, it's all mine, and yet I am going to, you know, I have the spirit of generosity. I gave my very self. So that is profoundly prophetic in a consumer culture. One story that I didn't tell in the book, just to kind of honor our relationship, but after the Orlando shooting, we do a thing called Change for a Dollar that I talk about in the book. Everybody puts a dollar in a bucket every week, and then that pot is there for the community. Anybody that sees a need outside of our church can respond.
Cool.
But I took one of those gifts to the Q Center in Portland, the primary sort of center for LGBTQ people that are, you know, it's, there's a clinic, there's education, there's all kinds of things. And took them a gift of a couple thousand dollars and just said, look, we know your community's hurting right now. You're probably getting inundated. It's a scary time. And had this great conversation. They were in tears and couldn't believe we show up with this. And for us, it wasn't like, wow, I didn't feel like we sacrificed a ton. But generosity coming from the church that, you know, is a big deal. I was gone on sabbatical this summer, and the executive director called, and it was really hot in this summer, like in the 90s, so for Portland.
Yeah.
That's scorcher.
Yeah.
And their air conditioning system went out, and it was $15,000. And he said, I don't have anybody to call. Is there anything you do? So my assistant gave it to one of our guys that sort of his job is to engage the city, and he made calls to I think six to eight other churches that were united with. In 4 hours, we raised the $15,000. And so when he sat down with them, he said, "This is coming from churches that you think hate you." And I want you to know, they don't hate you. They love you. And, of course, everybody's in tears. And they're, you know, trying to, like, understand what's happening.
Yeah, sure.
It's so bizarre.
Sure.
And yet, when I sit back and look at that story, and it's beautiful in a whole bunch of ways, but I wonder, in a progressively, you know, liberal Portland, why can't you raise $15,000? From so many affirming, you know, all this stuff, but you call the church. And I'm not, I just want to let the question sit there. I don't want to answer it or accuse anybody of anything. I want to say generosity is prophetic. It's otherworldly, and people don't know what to do with it.
Oh, that's powerful. That's a powerful story, and that is really true. Yeah, I want to sit with that for a little bit. I think people listening to the podcast, that's one of those, right?
But again, it changes us.
Yeah, there.
You know,
yes,
we have to go back and go. Again. You know, the churches are going, oh my gosh, can what if they can they name us? Can we be on the check? Can we, you know, like they're trying to figure it out. And, like, what's the right thing? Who's your neighbor? Who are you?
Yes,
And yet it also is this huge blessing as they experience the gift.
Yes.
And we give the gift. But it's also profoundly prophetic. So it's doing all three at once, which is what I love. I mean, it's so Jesus-like that when he calls us to obedience, it's like, man, everybody's getting turned upside down and blessed. And we're asking questions about what we've always held true, you know, and it's really wonderful.
Wow. You know, we're coming toward the end of our time, and you've got two or three more practices. What, pick one that you'd like to leave us with here today.
Yeah. Well, what are the other?
You got Sabbath, you got vocation, you got bless.
Yeah. Worship and Sabbath and vocation. Vocation, there's a lot being talked about on that right now. But what one of the ways we tried to unpack it was to look at singleness and marriage in there as calling, because we have so many singles who.
Say that again. I missed that word. Singleness and marriage as what?
As part of calling.
A call. Okay, thank you. All right.
You know?
Yep.
And that just sort of elevates so many singles that we have to go, look, this is, you're not second class till you get married. But Sabbath is one of those in our moment that is profoundly prophetic and transformational. And more people are talking about it and wrestling with it. But the transformation, the way it calls us into the gospel, is so orientating to what we're supposed to believe. And that is, this is God's world. I'm a person, not a machine. I'm made for enjoyment. And so when we disconnect whether that's from our device. I mean, so much is being created that's, I mean, you have forces that are going, we are spending billions of dollars to distract you, to make sure you are reduced to a consumer. Mm-hmm. If you look something up on Amazon, it shows up in every other web page you hit. You're like, what? Maybe God does want me to purchase this because there's almost a sense that our technology is becoming transcendent. The experience is this, being a consumer is a spiritual thing now. It shows up everywhere. When we unplug from that and we disconnect and we play, pray, eat, sit around as a family, that is profoundly peculiar in the moment. And it takes a radical infusion of grace to pull it off. Because I want to look at my phone every 15 minutes too. But if we can do it, man, I think our neighbors look at that and go, oh, that's, yes, yes, I want that. I want to rest, to not binge watch, but to rest. Yeah. And yet it's also prophetic because it says, we're not working for Babylon. We don't belong to your production. Mm. We work for human flourishing and we rest to get our souls back.
Wow. Once again, I can add nothing to that. Yeah, I'm sitting here thinking, you said every 15 minutes. I want to look at my phone every 15 minutes, too. In my head, I'm going, seconds. Yeah, right? Yeah. So I hear you there. That's really, really interesting. You know, what's your desire? What's your core message that you really hope people will take away with them if they pick up a copy of the book or hear you, you know, in some setting talk about this?
I think above all, I want them to be hopeful. There's so, you know, everything's so dire and so negative. Mm. But, you know, starting in Genesis 3, we pretty much are in exile, you know. And so it's not abnormal for this moment. Mm. But Jesus is faithful in exile. And if we can turn our lives towards him. The other thing that I think is beautiful is these practices aren't requiring you to do anything more, right? You eat, you spend, you work.
That's good.
You rest. All this is doing is saying the life that you're living now, we're going to turn that and turn it towards Christ so that the way we live is peculiar in, you know, this moment, but is also life-giving and experiencing Christ. So
that's a great point. You're not sitting here going, you got to add all these things in. That is a brilliant point. Yes.
Yeah, we're just wanting... So when Christ calls us to freedom, it's not a false call. Yeah. It's a real call. Mm-hmm. And it turns something as mundane as eating dinner, if I really show hospitality, into a moment of worship and connection, just because I opened up a space for another person. So I'm really hopeful. And for me, the thing that keeps me going is that when Jesus talks about the kingdom and the kingdom breaking in and we get to participate with him, it's this beautiful picture in my mind of another world that shows up in the midst of the darkness and it does the work itself. Mm-hmm. We don't have to manufacture. We have a guy that sits out in front of our church every Sunday with a bullhorn saying I'm the Antichrist. And,
really?
And, yeah.
Oh, I thought you were saying that like someone from your church. No, this is,
No, this is somebody else. But, he's working so hard.
Oh, man.
And you know, people love him and take him coffee and whatever. But it just reminds me that religion works so hard.
That's a great point.
And Jesus said, come to me, you who are weary. Mm. And Babylon is relentless. I mean, it's a rat race that we can't ever stop from. Mm. And Jesus says, no, I want you to have life, life abundant. Mm. So I think when I picture the kingdom, it's these people who are thriving and enjoying their life.
Yeah.
But also participating in heaven showing up in the world.
I love that. It's interesting. We live in a community that has a large pool. My husband and I go, you know, fairly frequently in the afternoon, and we've gotten to know this couple, and I was talking with someone else, but I overheard one of them say to him, "Wow, you know, you've gotten me to rethink faith. I mean, I haven't thought about any of this stuff in years. Like, I'm reading articles, and you know, you're not at all who I thought you'd be." Because my husband's a retired pastor.
Oh yeah.
And he's not, you know, he's not out there overtly talking about faith, but it's like, you know, it kind of oozes from him, not faith, but Jesus, you know? And mm-hmm. So it's just really interesting to hear that. And, you know, and this is over the course of a year or whatever. I don't know timing wise, but yes, you know, who are we? How do we turn toward Christ? So, and how are we personally transformed? Because really that is what, if I'll use that phrase, what oozes from our pores, really, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Oh, what a joy to have you share about your own life and the life of your, you know, body of friends and ragtag Christ followers in Portland. You know, carry on in that part of the country. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was so great to spend time with you.
Well, again, Rick McKinley's book is Faith for This Moment, Navigating a Polarized World as the People of God. A lot in the podcast today. And to everyone else, I say keep the conversation going.